This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Stage, sci-fi, spirituality, and sex. Where else but Joy 94.9?
Joyful, joyful.
Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
Good evening, faithful listeners, and welcome once again to the Spirit Lounge. We're here every Thursday on Joy 94.9 from 8 till 9, and I am joined by the lovely, lovely Reverend Joy. Hi, Joy.
Hi, Tal. I'm back.
Yes, you are. So we had sort of hinted at it before, but yes, Joy will be joining us every fourth Thursday of the month, so roughly, roughly once a month, basically.
With Reverend Kath, but Rev Kath is on holidays today.
Oh, well, so we'll have to catch her for next time.
Yeah, so she's listening. We're missing you, Rev Kath, and we look forward to seeing you next month.
I've wanted to start doing the holy day of the week. Yes, so that's our new section here on the Spirit Lounge, started last week, where we talk about some sort of event that has happened somewhere, or is about to happen, sorry, a festival somewhere around the world.
Yes, and for this one, we really need Nivy back, don't we?
I know. She just happens to not be around.
Oh. We need her back to do the pronunciation of all this stuff.
I know, and she's not even around so that I can ask her.
Because this festival is happening on the 24th of
January. Yeah. About to happen.
Okay, you tell us what it's called.
It is called... I'm going to try, and I apologize if I do get this one wrong.
I'm not even going to try.
Oh no! They're not so hard. They're not as hard, intimidating as they first seem. But it's Vasant Panchami. It's a Hindu festival. It's the celebration of the birthday of the goddess Saraswati. I believe that's how that's pronounced, or Saraswati, the goddess of knowledge and arts. I also saw it as wisdom. So kind of a few things. I saw it as sort of wisdom and knowledge, but sort of saying the sciences and the fine arts are sort of, that's sort of what they're talking about, that traditional approach to philosophy.
I love the way that the Hindus actually have all these gods of different things. I think it's quite wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is also that it depends on who you speak, how... metaphorical or mythological they are in the same way. Like the ancient Greeks didn't tend to really think that a lot of those gods really were gods. They were just sort of there for the sake of stories. But so it depends somewhat who you speak to, how they are. But it makes for a very interesting, certainly at least for us when we want to then go explore this. Fascinating stuff to go look at.
Yeah, and this festival seems to be celebrated by most Hindus. The form in which the celebration takes place seems to be different from country to country, but it's celebrated in spring, obviously, on the other side of the world.
Yeah, it translates, and the whole holiday really just translates to like fifth day of spring,
yeah,
roughly, or spring's fifth day, right? Just a grammar change there, but
yeah, which it seems a bit strange because we would imagine that they were still in the middle of winter, but anyway, that's the way it goes. And it's believed that on this day, which is the celebration of Saraswati, that her favourite colour is white, And so everyone is dressed in white, except I read about in India, they actually all dress in yellow. So yellow being in India, they in spring, they have yellow flowers of the mustard seed. So everything's yellow. So they dress, they equate spring to yellow. And so everyone dresses in yellow, whereas in other countries, they all dress in white.
Yeah, I saw quite radical differences, but depending on whether or not it was in Nepal or whether or not it was India. I sort of understood that historically it was actually connected to some of the Indian royal courts, and they would put on these festivals. So there was feast days in certain areas where now that doesn't exist as much. And so even though it's a fifth day of spring, there's been more emphasis on the goddess and the knowledge, wisdom type areas rather than the spring feast part as those things have changed.
And they give this goddess sweets, which the goddess then gives back to them if they attend the rituals.
I'm not sure how that all works.
But, I mean, if you take nice sweets, do you get those ones back or just
look, personally, I think any holiday which involves giving people and receiving sweets.
Does that include chocolates?
That immediately gives my A-OK. Interestingly, I don't know if you saw this, but this is one of those holidays that serves as a bit of a marker for a period of time between two holidays. I think a lot of religions have that, where there's this and then later on there's going to be holy, more towards the end of spring.
Holy is the one where they have all the colour, isn't it?
That involves the actual which if you've ever been to is really, really fun, by the way. It's a really great experience. But yeah, so holy's much, much later. And then there's this sort of holiday now, and then so it sometimes sort of ends as a, you know, those time markers. I saw in many ways it's sort of the equivalent to Lent, where you have these holidays which sort of say we're going to have another holiday
leading up to the big one.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things about this day is that they see it as the most auspicious day to begin laying one's foundation of education. So they preschool children are given their first lesson in reading and writing on this day.
Oh, that's a great tradition.
Yeah,
I really like
fabulous.
That.
Fabulous. And in all the educational institutions, they have special prayers on this day. But it's also a day in which they inaugurate training institutes and new schools. Is this day?
That's fantastic. Now, you've also got a prayer or a hymn for knowledge?
The hymn that they recite is, "May Goddess Sarah..." How do you say it? Saraswati. Who is fair like the jasmine-coloured moon and whose pure white garland is like frosty dew drops, who is adorned in radiant white attire, on whose beautiful arm rests the veena, and whose throne is a white lotus, who is surrounded and respected by the gods, protect me. May you fully remove my lethargy, sluggishness and ignorance. And that's for all the students out there about return to study.
Yes, that last line, I think we could all say over and over again, remove my sluggishness and ignorance, please.
As you're about to go back to school or start studying, I think that's a great one.
You're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9, and we've got a little message here from David Moyle. Thanks, David. G'day, Joy. Good to hear your voice on air. G'day, Tull. Looking forward to a great show tonight. David, thank you very much, David.
And, of course, David's from Bent Notes, which is on a Sunday night.
Oh,
from 7 till 9.
Oh, he loves being able to...
And we love jazz, David. We think it's fabulous.
And David loves telling every our Spirit Lounge listeners that he does Bent Notes. So.
I just thought I'd put a plug in for him, you see, because he's not here to do it for himself.
I know, and he really does put in quite a bit of time helping us out here at the Spirit Lounge.
He does. We love him.
So now, Joy, you wanted to talk about water and water symbolism and stuff like that, and that was sort of what we organized to be doing for the next few times that you're on. And then we sort of said, well, how fortuitous, considering the holy day of the week that we've just covered.
Yes.
So why don't we start this meeting between you and I, where we're going to do this for the next few, by covering Hinduism and the relationship between Hinduism and water.
Yeah, and the reason I decided to do this was I actually was at church and the reading was about Jesus being baptized, and I was thinking about the whole use of water in different religions.
Well, yeah, because it's certainly not unique to Christianity.
And it's across all religions, is that water is very symbolic. So we, as you said, we're going to talk about Hinduism and water. And we've already talked about the fact that Hinduism, like Christianity, like Judaism, like everything else, encompasses a wide range of beliefs. So why are we putting this out there? Every, I guess, order or country or whatever, they have different symbolism, different beliefs around it. But there is this prevailing belief that's shared by most of them is the importance of physical and spiritual cleanliness and well-being, you know, a striving to attain purity and avoid pollution. And this widespread aspiration leads itself to a reverence for water, as well as the integration of water into most Hindu rituals, as it believes that water has spiritually cleansing powers.
Now, you're also, there's something about the holy places, temples and such, are often around rivers or lakes and other bodies of water, or at least incorporate water heavily into their...
Yeah,
their structure.
They're usually, holy places are usually located on the banks of rivers, coasts, seashores, and mountains. And what is even better is where the land converges with two rivers or three rivers.
Oh, like a fork.
So they like, what do they call them? A delta or estuary. They like those sorts of places because they carry a lot of special significance. But they consider water to be a purifier, a life giver. Well, we can't survive without water, can we? And also a destroyer of evil.
Ooh,
I'm not
I like
sure
that
how
one.
That happens.
I like that one. Well, I mean, I think we both come from a background that knows that likes to make comments about floods. So you never know.
Yeah, and milk and water are symbols of fertility, and an absence of which can cause barrenness and sterility, leading to death.
Well, I think I think that probably applies a little better with the milk part. It was probably implied. It was probably implied a little that if you don't drink water, you'll probably die.
But, I think that's actually probably a surety. You will die.
Yes, I think.
Yes,
I think so.
It's interesting that in the past, temple tanks were part of every large Hindu temple. And this is quite interesting because the water was holy and had cleansing properties, and it was an unwritten rule that they would take a dip in the temple tank before offering prayers to whatever deities.
Oh,
they were
so it's like
to.
A large a basin of
like
some kind.
Almost a baptism every time.
I was a bit confused
in.
When you said temple tank.
Yeah.
It was like a...
Not a tank that shoots
like
and runs over things. No. But those tanks also would serve as a useful reservoir to help communities if the rains didn't come. Because obviously in places like India and other places, they're really dependent on the monsoons to get their water. And if that didn't happen, well, then they didn't have the water. So they were dependent on those tanks. But unfortunately, apparently, these days, most of the tanks are in a state of neglect.
Well,
they've lost that reservoir.
I can imagine at least on that thing that it might be somewhat less necessary. I mean, maybe it still is, but historically religious institutions or temples have often sort of helped out in terms of social welfare in some way. And of course today, definitely my understanding is still in India, there's lots of places where there's lots of providing of food from temples and stuff like that. And maybe the water is just one of those ones that's died out somewhat.
Yes, I'm not sure I'd want to drink the water if everyone has bathed in it.
Well, if you've got nothing else,
but of course,
we're saving lives.
The Gandhi is considered a great sacred place, isn't it? And people go down and bathe in it and float their bodies out or some. Yeah. No, there's something to do with dead bodies happens around the Ganges River, doesn't
it? I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, but it's one of their most important sacred rivers.
Yeah,
and people are expected that at some time in their life they're going to go down and bathe in the Ganges River.
Unfortunately, it's very... Today, the Ganges is very, very polluted. It's quite sad. People continue to still dip into it. And of course, if you were to move further up and actually into the mountains where the Ganges starts, it is once again beautiful, crystal water. It's just unfortunate that I think so many people who are participating in this ritual unfortunately have to do it in an area where it's not yeah. that same clean place.
Yeah. Water plays quite a significant role in death as well, because many funeral grounds are located near the rivers, and after cremation the mourners bathe in the river before returning to their homes. And the ashes are actually cast into the river on the 10th day after they have been cremated. So there you go. So there's all sorts of things in the river.
Now, there's quite a few different. I saw that in times past, a king was sprinkled with water in order to purify him at his coronation. Yep. There's involving sipping of water three times. There's other sort of festivals like that.
I like the one that immediately after childbirth, a close relative of the child pulls a few drops of water on the body of the child used in his right hand. And it said that the child will get the character of this person. So you want to be very sure who you're allowed to drip water on them.
By the way, David's written again just to say what? Thanks for the bent notes message.
Now you're giving him another plug.
I know, he gets a double. Well, I thought I'm not going to go too far and do the whole one that he sort of puts in there.
Goodness me. People chant mantras standing in water, and they do a penance by standing under a continuous downpouring of water. I've seen that when they stand under waterfalls that are freezing cold, and that's their penance, and they chant while they're standing under there.
I'm just wondering, is that as in they're standing under because it's when you say penance, do you mean as in that's what they're doing just as sort of a sorry, or is it like a punishment, or is it
I do this
as a sort of a symbol of?
I'm not sure whether they're, you know, instructed to do it or whether they choose to do it, but they do it and they stand under this icy cold waterfall and they chant and they say mantras and yeah.
I'm gonna go look that up later.
Yeah, but it's quite interesting that you know, the use of water in most of their rituals. In fact, I would think, but
it's present, and certainly, by the way, if we as we talk about more faiths, I think you'll see how many. It's not just that water is common, but the purpose of water is often very common as well. There's so many things I'm looking at here, going, "Oop, yep, send that somewhere else, send that somewhere else." So, you know, yeah, especially.
Next time we're actually going to talk about water in Christianity and Judaism.
Yeah, and you see many, many crossovers there.
And you're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. Today I noticed on Facebook a lot of people commenting about the death of Marcus Borg, and we thought that we would get someone on to talk about who he was, and we have invited Stuart Edser. So welcome to Spirit Lounge, Stuart.
Well, hello, Joyce. Thanks for having me on.
Now, Stuart, first up, who was Marcus Borg?
Well, Marcus Borg was a Christian theologian and scholar in early church history, in Jesus the Man and the early origins of Christianity. He was born in 1942 into a Lutheran family, and eventually got into the world of academia, and for many, many years he trained many people and did his own research. So eventually Borg became involved with a group of Jesus scholars that you might have heard of called the Jesus Seminar, and these were not necessarily ordained men and women, but university academics, as well as some ordained people, whose mission it was to look at the life of Jesus and the history of Jesus as presented in the early writings, and to see what we could make of that from modern-day scholarship. So these people looked at, you know, history and archaeology and linguistics and ancient Greek and Hebrew, and they really did a fabulous job in trying to work out who the historical Jesus really was. And Marcus Borg was a member of that group who also happened to be an incredibly gifted writer and was able to make very, very sometimes esoteric and ancient and difficult and complex issues very readable and very, very understandable to the modern reader.
Now, he was labelled as progressive Christian, would that be right?
Yes, very much so. He was at the vanguard of progressive Christianity.
What is progressive Christianity?
Well, progressive Christianity is a form of the Christian faith that's really grown up over the last, well, look, don't quote me, but maybe, you know, 40-odd years or so, and perhaps going back even further into that tradition of the Jesus Seminar and even their precursors. And what progressive Christianity tries to do is to use modern scholarship rather than just, church teaching or traditional conservative views to look at the faith and to how it can be engaged today. So Borg, for example, in progressive Christianity, he looked at a number of areas. So first of all was the Bible. He saw the Bible as sacred scripture, definitely, but something that was written by human beings, two ancient faith communities, the ancient Israelites and the early Christians. Progressive Christians would see the Bible as being a human product that is neither inerrant nor to be taken literally, but to be read not at face value, but very, very carefully.
But they still see it as inspired, don't they?
They still see it as inspired, but not necessarily, you know, dictated by God to some kind of secretary who just wrote it all down verbatim.
So I've sometimes seen what they talk about as red letter Christianity, where there's Bibles might have, when it's directly something Jesus said in red letters, to really identify, you know, this specifically is the word straight from the mouth of God. Does that, would, I guess, progressive Christianity wouldn't necessarily consider that?
That kind of stuff. You'll find Tony Campolo is involved in that kind of work. And look, progressive Christianity certainly does look at the texts of the Gospels, and they've done their very best with modern scholarship to try to determine what words are, we can say, you know, definitely, what words are maybe and what words are probably not the words of Jesus or the accounts of what happened. So certainly that kind of thing is in keeping. The second thing about progressive Christianity is the nature of salvation itself. Conservative Christianity has always been about basically getting your ticket to heaven and avoiding going to hell. It's always about your eternal soul and your eternal salvation. Whereas progressive Christianity talks more about what the faith does for you in this life as part of the human condition. So salvation is more about transformation in this life rather than what comes next, which is either going to heaven or avoiding going to hell.
One of the things that I think Borg got criticised for was his views on the virgin birth.
Well, a lot of people, for example, out of this tradition, don't necessarily believe that some of the stories that we've all grown up with are literally true,
yeah,
that they still contain a truth, but maybe that is not factual. So, you know, there's a lot of scholarship around Jesus' birth and who Mary was, and perhaps who Joseph was, and how all that happened. So I think I'd probably add that part of progressive Christianity and part of Borg's push, if you like, is to say that Christianity is not and should never be a set of principles or conditions that you have to believe in order to be in order to be thought orthodox and acceptable. That Christianity is much more about a transformation within of your own life and how you are in this world, rather than believing in a set of principles.
Yeah, and one thing that I guess is really good for many of our listeners is that progressive Christianity talks about being inclusive of all people, regardless of your gender, your sexual orientation, anything else, your abilities, your class, that all people are accepted.
Very much so, very much. The whole I guess the push of progressive Christianity in terms of human beings and God's relationship to human beings is that God is passionate about the earth and the people of the earth, and that Jesus came perhaps to show us a way, a better way, rather than rules and regulations and religion, to ways to engage with God, but also ways to engage with each other.
Now, Stuart, John Shelby Spong, he's progressive?
John Shelby Spong has also been part of the Jesus Seminar and is also a prolific author. He and Borg were friends, and Spong has his own style and his own, authorial mission in the way he writes his books. I'm not sure that Borg and Spong would be absolutely in total agreement on every single thing. Perhaps they probably wouldn't, but certainly they are. They're from essentially the same camp. Yes.
Yeah. What Marcus Borg has written a lot of books. Can you tell us a bit about some of them?
Yes, certainly. Look, his Wikipedia. I was just having a look at his Wikipedia entry. There are 27 books there listed. I don't think it's 27. There are probably a couple of chapters in other books there, but it's getting up there. Borg really, really hit the big time in 1994 with a book called Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time. It's a snappy title, and it really, really put him out there in the marketplace for the general reader. And this was about his research scholarship into the historical Jesus. So in Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, he talks about the pre-Easter Jesus and the post-Easter Jesus being very, very, very different. In 2001, he did a similar thing and used a similar kind of title, where he called his book, it's about the Bible, it's called Reading the Bible Again for the First Time, Taking the Bible Seriously but Not Literally.
Wow.
And in that book, Borg goes through and shows different ways of reading the Bible and brings his considerable scholarship to that endeavour. In 2006, he rewrote an earlier book about Jesus himself and brought in, I think, an extra 15 years of work, and it's just called Jesus, Uncovering the Life, Teachings and Relevance of a Religious Revolutionary. So this is where it's a biography and story about who Jesus was and kind of the kind of world that he lived in and what he was on about. So he's been an incredible author. His last book was actually just last year, and it's a wonderful book. 3 years ago, when he turned the age of 70, he was asked by a group to do a talk about kind of where he was at now as a 70-year-old with the whole of the Christian faith and American Christianity in particular. So he turned that talk into a book called Convictions, How I Learned What Matters Most. And it's a really wonderful read. There's a little bit of overlap with some of his earlier material, but it's very human, it's very warm, it's scholarly, but he brings together a whole lot of stuff that he'd been working on his whole academic and faith-filled life, just to explain what he felt that he could say is now a conviction in his life. So it's a really, really fabulous read.
Well, thank you very much for that, Stuart. And if people are interested in learning more about Marcus Ball or getting any of his books, you can do a search on Google. And he is obviously going to be missed by many. And
he will be indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. You're on Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9.
And we're going to cover a little bit of news for this week.
The first one's quite an interesting one. There's a Tory MP has come out as an atheist. And he is saying that it is hard to be non-religious within the Conservative Party, obviously in the UK, as it is to be a gay Tory.
Yeah, this is James Arbuthnot, who is the former Conservative Chief Whip and the MP for North East Hampshire. And he came out, quote-unquote, in a speech.
The only reason he came out, which is quite sad, is because he's actually leaving.
He's leaving, so he finally said.
And they were having a debate on prayers at council meetings, and he said, this is, quote, I shall disappoint people by saying I am not in the least religious. This is the first time, however, that I have acknowledged that in public. It may be true that the pressure on a Conservative politician in particular to keep quiet about not being religious is very similar to the pressure that there has been about keeping quiet about being gay. And he said he's not gay.
Yeah. He's saying not that I am gay, but and I'm not sure how some people feel about that, but I can understand that sentiment. The equivalent that it for in some areas, saying I'm an atheist is the equivalent of saying I'm gay in many areas.
But I don't know. We had a prime minister that was an atheist.
Oh, was very true. Absolutely, yeah. Very true. But it depends on the environment. You can imagine. I'll use the hypothetical of that. You know, you imagine you're in, let's say, a country town. There's less people, and you happen to be in one of those areas where the question is not, do you go to church? The question is, what church do you go to? And in that environment, to say nothing and I don't believe in God can often be for many people the equivalent, like. The people you're telling, to them it can be like the equivalent of saying, I don't believe in morals. You know, like that's the way people can take it. So
I remember my brother moved to America from the UK and he lived in a small town and they were disgusted because he didn't go to church. You know, it was like, well, what church are you going to attend? Well, I'm not.
Yeah, and it's like, but
and
how
there was
can
a lot
not?
Of pressure at his workplace that he should go to church somewhere.
Yeah, that definitely happens. And I know that's been quite a thing sometimes you hear if you read sort of atheist literature, I guess, to put it. Sometimes you'll see this concept of coming out atheist for pop up occasionally. Now, other news piece is the Pope is back in our news. We sometimes discuss the Pope here.
Yeah. He's not popular at the moment, is he? He's attacked same-sex marriage, saying that those who support it are attempting to redefine the very institute of marriage. This was while he was in the Philippines, he made these comments. And this is despite having recently appeared to be softening his stance on the issue of gay or lesbian couples marrying. So, you know, I don't know if he's just backing down or whether he actually... what he's up to, really.
Look, I mean, obviously the Pope is not a religious leader that personally, due to my own background, is something that I look at, and maybe for other people, obviously, the Pope is a very important figure, and I don't want to disrespect that in any way. But at the same time, I think we've seen a lot of people do the other way around. It's not necessarily as much that the Pope has... softened as much as that people take every little word of let's not be crazy about it, and people have said, oh my God, the attitude's going to change. And to me sometimes the comments seem a bit hopeful, but
he also said that the Catholic Church must help parents to stand by their gay children.
Okay.
So I guess he has softened a bit, but it must be very difficult for people who are Catholic. And as you say, that they get all excited because they hear this. But we saw this recently with Hillsong and their leader, who said one thing and then suddenly someone, you know, calls him on it, and so he backs down on it. And I think that it's pretty rough on people who are Catholic that think, well, okay, maybe we are going to see a change. But then we're not.
But this is what I say, you know, clear what to me that what we have is that same sort of thing of saying, look, just because we're not going to think that it's okay to be, GLBTI, it doesn't mean that we have to cast them out of the community, right? That's the attitude that we've got here, and that's nice. It's better, but this is not... This is still behind on the overall scale of various sects of various religions that have made that decision. You know, we're already often at a different stage. So it's obviously unfortunate, but I think it's also worth noting that, because I don't think we also just want to turn a blind eye, right? As in, we don't want to just say, oh, well, at least they're not saying we'll kill them, you know? It's no, I mean, if we want... supposedly, this is someone to an extent speaks through or behalf of God, and if there's something that I don't like, then I'm not going to say, oh, well, it's just politics or it's just this. That's not good enough, right, to me. My understanding is that Jesus was willing to die to get his opinions out there, and so I think it's a real shame when religious institutions, I say obviously just in the case of Christian institutions, play politics.
And people look on the Pope very in high regard, so listen to a lot of what he said. But finally, there's a survey, and I'm sure that we're not completely shocked by this, but a high number of gay and lesbian Mormons have undergone attempts to cure themselves of their same-sex attraction. Now, you've studied Mormons, so you know a bit about this.
Attempts was the key word there, I think.
A survey of 1,612 gay and lesbian Mormons by Utah State University found that 80% of respondents had tried to change their sexual orientation, that 70% of gay and lesbian Mormons leave the Church of the Latter-day Saints.
70%, very high. I think you'll find that there's quite a few churches where if you really look for long enough, why do so many people leave? Because they're gay.
They've also found that 70% of marriages involving a gay man and a woman ended in divorce. Isn't it?
What were the chances of that?
Compared to 25% of marriages between a straight man and a woman.
Well, that's definitely a much higher... It would be pretty hard to say that they're unrelated. You've been listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. We're at the end of another show.
And it's good night from Rev Joy.
And good night from Tal.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.